Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 39, where we are discussing Cohen, March, and Olson's 1972 article, A Garbage Can Model of Organizational Choice, that appeared in the Administrative Science Quarterly. This is Ralph coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And this is Pedro coming to you from Brasilia in Brazil.
This is Miranda coming to you from Udine in Italy.
And this is Tom coming to you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
So it's truly an international collection of podcasters.
Yes, indeed.
So, Pedro, would you give us a summary of the article and some of the major points, and then Tom will follow along with some of the more technical aspects of the simulation?
Yes, certainly. So, first thing I want to say is that this episode is actually part of our series on the Carnegie Mellon School. We had episode 4, in which we talked about routines, and episode 19, in which we talked about organizational learning. And in this one, we are going to explore decision-making, and specifically decision-making in anarchical situations, so to speak. So a brief introduction for the Carnegie Mellon School. It was very important in the development of organizational theory. It was very strong in the 50s, 60s, and somehow the 70s. And it had names like Jean March, Herbert Simon, Richard Syard associated to them. This school was very important in organization management because it was one of the first attempts to take the organizational theory field from the more ideas based on the experience of people that had worked in organizations like Taylor and others, and doing a more formal study of how organizations are and how they function. The Carnegie Mellon tradition is also identified by a multidisciplinary approach, although I would say that economics and cognitive psychology plays a special role. There's a strong focus on formal approaches, you know, propositions, quantitative modeling, computer simulation in this case. So it's less about naturalist inquiries. And there's attention to some topics like decision-making and the cognitive limits of decision-making. They were very important also because although it might appear a bit orthodox today for us, it was very revolutionary in that context. You know, it really challenged ideas about perfect rationality and assumptions about behavior that came from neoclassical economics, and also put organizations as a real actor, you know, before there is this idea that, especially in economics, that organizations are just made by individuals. And I think they were one of those who actually pushed for this idea that organizations have emergency properties. This paper, however, is interesting because it's kind of an enfant terrible in this tradition, because whereas most of the work of the Carnegie Mellon is more about, you know, decision making in certain situations of bounded rationality, but it's still very much in the standard rationality of how organizations functions kind of umbrella, this one tackles a more complicated and interesting case, which exactly this idea of trying to make sense of how decision making happens in anarchic organizations or situations, which are what they classify as situations characterized by problematic preferences, unclear technology, or fluid participation.
One thing I would add when we were talking about unclear technology, that does, in this sense, the technology does not refer to artifacts or machines or pieces of hardware. It means an understanding of how the organization functions and makes decisions. And so it means that the members of the organizations of the organization do not fully understand how it works.
Also, the paper itself is very concentrated on presenting a model. What the authors tried to do is to put together a demonstration of the garbage can model through a simple mathematical simulation. The mathematical simulation included things such as access structures, which represented the choices that came through, the decisions that were made, that could be made, the actions of decision makers, the energy levels in which they would have or have available to them in order to make decisions. And the idea was not a simulation in what we call the modern sense, in which you're actually trying to model the all aspects of the decision behavior. What they're primarily doing is just presenting an idea of what it looks like when you have problems, solutions, and choices basically presenting themselves in somewhat of a more random fashion, as opposed to a deterministic, here's a problem, attach a solution to it, and move on. It does dominate the paper. It's not an empirical simulation by any means, but I'll be talking about this a little bit more later on in the episode.
Yeah, and I would add one other thing, is that the paper's authors see the model as a first step towards looking at the interrelatedness of the organizational phenomena that they're talking about, and trying to understand how they connect, as opposed to how people actually influence them. And I think that's one of the reasons why the paper was so important and for its time.
I was going to say, should we talk about what the garbage can is?
Absolutely.
Yes,
okay,
please.
So from what I understand, you know, the core of the paper is trying to put forward a behavior theory of organized anarchy, you know, so how decision-making happens in such situations. And I think the main core idea is that it's trying to uncouple decisions and solutions, you know, problems and choices. And it's trying to unravel how actually in anarchical situations we can have solutions that follow problems, not the other way around, as we usually think of them.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. And I think the other thing that might help our listeners is choices might be thought of as opportunities to make decisions, but they themselves are not the decisions. And the best description I saw of the garbage can is early in the article, and it says, the authors say that you can view a choice opportunity as a garbage can into which various kinds of problems and solutions are dumped by participants as they are generated. And the mix of the garbage, or the things that are in the can, depend on the kinds of cans available, the labels that are put on the alternate cans, the garbage currently being produced, and the speed with which garbage is collected and removed. So it's an interesting way of thinking about, and I think, obviously they don't mean garbage in a literal sense, but just stuff, you know, going in to this can, and that gives you these opportunities for making decisions.
So it's a metaphor to say the assumptions and the variables that they tackle in the paper, which is what kind of solutions are there, what kind of problems are there, how they are interrelated, what kind of participants are there, what kind of, you know, this thing that they call the energy in which participants can make decisions, and so on and so forth.
I think one of the other things that's important about it, the article, and that Tom alluded to it earlier, was the idea that you it's not the classical way of looking at decision making in organizations. They look at choice opportunities differently than what you classically think of them as occurring, or the way they might classically occur in organizations, which would go from recognition of a problem to generation of decision alternatives to examination of the consequences of these decision alternatives, then an evaluation of the consequences in terms of the overall objectives of the organizations, and those would produce the decision. And as Pedro was talking about earlier, in organized anarchy and this technical ambiguity, it's not always clear what the objectives and the needs are of the organization.
Obviously, I talked about the mathematical model, but the mathematical model also kind of came from somewhere. And the latter portion of the article tries to take these different ways in which decisions present themselves, choices become available, and sort of matched it with colleges and universities. Said that certain types of colleges might exercise their garbage can one way. Access through different levels of energy, different ways in which decisions are made, different linkages between choices or problems and solutions, and then generalized it to think about, well, if we can see these different types of universities doing these different behaviors based on the way in which they conduct business, then we can make some pretty general or build towards a more general theory based on the garbage can that says that any organization, based on how you perceive or how you model internally problem solutions, choices, etc., can say a lot about how you make decisions, whether you make them efficiently, whether you make them inefficiently, and whatnot. Again, it's not empirical. It's intended to be very clearly a demonstration and a description of what the potential that the model provides.
It's, for me, hearing you say that and rethinking about the paper, it's very much, I think, an argument of the method in madness, you know. And I think especially from where you're coming from trying to, you know, to reform neoclassic economics, it's very much that, you know, it's this acknowledgement that there is not this perfect situation in which there are shared goals and complete clarity about things, but nevertheless, there is still, a reason, a structure in the ways things take place.
I wanted to build on Pedro's point, and I think one of the major strengths of this article is that it acknowledges the messy side of organizations. So we have all these decision-making and models and organizational theory concepts that are kind of idealistic, and you have this organization that knows where it's going, where it came from, knows what it's doing. But here you have sort of not a push towards an idealism, but an acknowledgement of reality, which is given by these organized anarchies, and the fact that there is an attempt to model what actually happens in reality. And I find that quite fascinating. And the case of universities or of public educational organizations is actually quite fitting. And I think it actually explains things quite well. If we think how many times we're in a university organization and it's quite clear that not all the parts know what the others are doing, we explain quite a lot of that reality.
Can you say a bit more about that? Because I was actually not very convinced why universities are such a good example.
Not convinced?
Yeah, I was just not, seemed a bit arbitrary to me. That's the only.
So let me try, and then, because I do want to say, Miranda, that was a great observation of a theme. Neo talks about how it's not an empirical paper, but it sure seems, based on the way the paper's written, that the authors are taking their general perceptions of something, an organization they know well, the university, and then they're generalizing them with some assumptions and some rules that they created to say, well, what do these interrelations look like, or what might the implications of this be? And I think that it's they're trying to show some insights, as opposed to it being, like Tom said, it's not empirical, but there is some empirical basis for it based on their experience. Is this probably not as what we would normally see in an empirical paper?
So I just wanted to throw one thing in. I do agree that I'm a bit skeptical on the idea of goal ambiguity, in the sense that I don't see universities as these organizations that are just completely lost, because that's the idea you get from the writing of the article, that there is absolutely no idea where they're going, no idea, and it's basically having all these solutions which are looking for problems. I don't think universities are like that, but if we were to, I think that's a bit stretched. So if we look at it, there are actually quite a lot of goals that universities have that are conflicting, or there is no clear priority. So there's teaching, there is competing, conflicting. There's teaching, there's research, there's also technology transfer or contributions to society.
What I was thinking was, in a way, because the article was a product of its time, and the idea of an organizational anarchy was somewhat new. Now that we've accepted it, I think we're now starting to kind of see it as, like, to me now, organizational anarchy is almost it is not what I would use to have described it. It's not the metaphor I would think of, because, anarchy in a way suggests that there is a lack of control, or everybody for themselves. Whereas perhaps something, some other metaphor might be more apt now, which might talk about independence, some mix of independence and interdependence, where you have a lot of individual actors, perhaps in the university setting, or individual communities of practice, like you would have in a very large organization, that are sort of doing their own thing under the umbrella, under a single identity of a much, much larger organization. We might not think of that as anarchic anymore. We might think of that as just churn. So some of the challenges that we might have with it is just simply the choice of the metaphor used at the time. Like, you know, would we use garbage can now? Is that the best metaphor we would come up with for what we have now considered to become somewhat normal organizational behavior, as opposed to what it was at the time, which was clearly counter the conventional wisdom?
It is, however, a very catchy title.
That is too.
Yes, yes. And that may be one of the reasons why they chose it, because it stands out. And I think I like Tom's use of the word anarchic, right? Because not necessarily completely an anarchy, but like Miranda was saying, you have these conflicting goals or some goal ambiguity, or some people, I mean, one of the other things I was going to add on to what she was saying was, not only do you have these multiple goals, but multiple actors in the organization interpret the goals differently. And
can I also add, you also have actors that are, in the case of universities, there is a strong individual dimension.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
There is an organizational dimension, but academics are very individualistic, or can be.
Yeah, that's what Tom was saying, that actually parts of the organization are semi-autonomous, and the garbage can model has been used to analyze organizations such as the military and the UN peacekeeping operations and policy making. That's actually in governmental policy is one of the areas where it's been applied the most. And so there's other opportunities to see how this might apply without saying, okay, it's complete anarchy. You just see that there's features of that kind of process going on.
Can I just rewind very quickly? So if I understand it correctly, the idea of using the universities as the illustration here is probably because they were familiar with that, you know, so.
That's what I think.
I have a question. Yeah. So in the first part of the article, they list public, educational, and illegitimate organizations as examples of where a garbage can model can be applied. What do you think they mean by illegitimate organizations?
Perhaps unnamed organizations, collectives that behave as an organization but did not establish or explicitly establish an identity ad hoc.
Or maybe just, you know, there's this differentiation between former organizations and organized social activity. You know, you can have...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Something like non-former organizations, okay. Like not the ones that are registered as organizations, you know, in economic and legal terms, but it's organized activity that, you know, I think of informal community kind of arrangements, initiatives, you know, which are organized activity, but not necessarily formal organization.
Okay.
Should we say a bit more about, you know, the makeup of the model, you know, the things that they talk about, such as decision styles and the structure of distribution of energy and blah, blah.
One of the areas of the paper that's not exactly a theme, but it runs through, or these terms run throughout the paper and the descriptions and sometimes get confusing, are things like choice opportunity. The authors use language that is a little bit unfamiliar, but that refers to occasions when an organization is expected to produce behavior that could be called a decision. So kind of a roundabout way of describing a decision opportunity. And then when they're looking at ways to model the organizations, they look at something called access structure, which is not necessarily the access to people in the organization, but it's the relationship between problems and choices. And it refers to the access problems have to choices, which removes the actors completely. And I have some concerns about that, but that's what the authors do. Then they refer to something called decision structure, which is the availability of decision makers to participate in making choices. And Tom and Pedro both talked about how people in the organization that make decisions have limited amounts of time and energy, and decisions come at them from various directions. And sometimes they participate and sometimes they don't. And those things vary over time. And then they refer to something which raised my eyebrows, and not in a bad way, but something I had to just think deeply about. And they call it the solution coefficient. And that's a number between 0 and 1 that impacts the decision energy any individual participant will have. And they need that variable later, because they talk about decision makers being available for high and low decisions and their energy levels. And then something that's very important to the paper about, particularly with respect to the problems that actually get decisions made and resolved, something called the net energy load. And that's the difference between the total energy required to solve all the problems and then the total effective energy available to the organization over all time periods, right? So essentially, if you have a mismatch, you're going to have problems, or you're going to solve all of your problems and be able to move on quickly. Then they also talked about energy distribution, in that the decision makers don't have unlimited sources of energy, but also energy varies over time. So it's not just one time period. They may have lots of energy for something, and then, say, in a university setting, an academic may have a particularly important proposal deadline coming, or a research project they have to finish or something, which means they would have much less energy available to work on some problem. So those vary over time. And then they refer to something called problem activity, which is the amount of time unresolved problems are actively attached to choice situations. So that's I had some trouble getting my brain around that one. And the way I think of that is that, okay, you have, just because you get a problem attached to a choice doesn't mean it's solved. In fact, you could say, well, we've made a choice, but it doesn't really fix the problem. And they talk about later how the problem will migrate to a different choice if the circumstances are favorable to do so.
Just a clarification, I think we might say, because there are many elements here. So I just want to say that, you know, from what I understand, what the author is doing is that they have these very key concepts, variables, things that are thrown into the garbage can, and the idea is to see the interdependency. So I think we can just list what they are, which are the problems, the solutions, the participants, choice opportunities, and they talk about all these things related to, you know, the flow of solutions, the way the problems flow, and the energy that the participants have. And I think what they try to, the simulation is actually to look at that, from what I understand, is try to see how these different things, according to different structures, intermesh. And these structures, from what I understand, are both fruit of managerial planning, but also just the change and learning that an organization goes through. So you can have a structure in which problems are, for some reason, structured in a more hierarchical way, in which specific problems can only be decided by specific people and can be only attached to specific solutions, or it can be to, you know, more horizontal, and so on and so forth. You know, so they try to use different kind of for known organizational structures to think of the different ways in which the problems can be structured, or the solutions, or the energy can be distributed. And that, you know, becomes the fuel for the simulation.
The thing that struck me was, you know, the lengths that they took to try to present three very contrasting access structures, three very contrasting decision structures, three very contrasting energy distribution. And, you know, unfortunately, because they presented all of the elements of the model and included the full source code, in Fortran as an appendix, you actually have the ability to encode this yourself and try it out for yourself, and potentially even, try some other access structures. Now, what they went with was, the structures that they put into the demonstration are fixed. So basically, if you go in with a decision structure that says that any decision maker can enact any active choice opportunity. It stays that way for the entire simulation. Of course, when we think about real organizational settings, and if we were to try to model this more precisely, perhaps, we'd be looking at something a bit more dynamic where the decision structure changes based on the situation. But again, this was presented as a demonstration. This is a way of illustrating the different ways in tying it to the universities later in the paper and say that, okay, we're going to set up these access structures unsegmented, specialized, or hierarchical. And we, by our experience, have seen that universities of particular types kind of sort of follow these generally. So when they modeled it or when they ran this model, they had something to work on, which they said, okay, the outputs, that kind of sort of looks like what we have seen actual decision making going on in this particular type of a university.
They make a clear statement about that it looks like what they've seen in many circumstances. And I think that's important. That's why they chose the university as sort of the baseline of the model. So now I want to move ahead in the implications of the model that the authors conclude. And this is on page 9 of the text. They talk about 8 major properties of the garbage can decision processes based on the simulation that they ran. And, you know, some of these are maybe more or less applicable to actual decision situations. So the authors look at 8 major properties of the garbage can decision processes. And I think some of these are worth talking about a little bit further. And they talk about, for example, decision making in the model is frequently by flight and oversight are the most common types of decision, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Should we tell what they are?
Would you please?
So there are 3 decision styles that they talk about. One is the traditional one, which they call by resolution, which is when some choices are resolved after, you know, a period in which people work on them. But there's also other 2 that they introduce. One is by oversight, decision by oversight, and decision by flight. In decision by oversight, they say that it happens when a choice is activated, when problems are attached to other choices, and if there is energy available to make the new choice quickly. So from what I understand here, it's kind of almost like reusing the solution, from what I understand.
Yes, that's what it looked like to me too, that oversight, it's when you already have the problem attached to choices, but then you basically switch because you have enough energy to make a new choice, and you make the choice quickly. So you're making a quick choice switch. And it wasn't clear. I'm with you, Pedro. I'm a little confused. Wasn't clear whether that's because somebody senior makes that decision or it's an oversight in that we missed something. That the use of oversight is a bit ambiguous for me there. But that's the basic idea, is that you make a change in the decision to something new.
I was thinking that both in the case of oversight and flight, I'm not sure if I confuse them now, but it's kind of like understandable if you see it in the context of employees that are particularly autonomous. So they're able to basically switch choices or just abandon them or just not choose to be involved. That's how I saw it in reality. But I'm not sure if I read too much.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thing. When I think about, let's say that you have an intractable problem and you've got a whole bunch of people in your organization who are trying to solve this problem. They have different solutions available to them. They're trying to make it work. And then somebody comes in with this brilliant idea. And then all energy moves to the brilliant idea until everybody realizes, oh, this is stupid. And then they abandon it. That was almost what I thought of when I saw oversight. It's just, you just try to migrate to the next big thing if you have a problem that just isn't getting solved, because you don't want to continue expending your energy if it looks like it's going nowhere. Some bright shiny light out there says here's a really great path to success. You know, go for it. Then
So what I would add to that though is that is largely flight, where you're moving to a new choice. And it seems to me where the difference between flight and because flight says they specifically say the problem has not been successfully attached to choices. You've got them, but it basically doesn't fit any of the choices. Whereas oversight is you've actually had made a choice, but then it moves to a new one because this, you know, that stupid idea comes out very quickly and you say, oh, we should really just be doing this.
Yeah.
Well, to be quite fair, there are parts where I struggle with the article. This
Absolutely,
is one of the parts because you know, this idea of a world where we're surrounded by problems for me is particularly sad in the sense that
I agree. That's a great way to say it.
So in the sense that it's nice that once in a while the article talks about solutions. It's kind of like a light out there. But this idea of being surrounded by so many problems, it's not good on my morale. So that's one thing. But it's also an interesting point because if you go to the research in entrepreneurship and you try to locate this in the world of businesses, besides the fact that I really hope that businesses have a clearer sense of their goals, but that's another story. In entrepreneurship, you talk about opportunities. And opportunities is a concept which is much more hopeful, right? There's a very large debate on the fact, are opportunities out there or do the entrepreneurs discover them? But then you move to here and you find all these problems. So that is one thing. The other thing that I find sad, just to connect the dots, is that this idea of problems being treated, being handled, and then being abandoned into the void, I don't know. I just struggle with this point.
Well, let me try this. So in the flight, if you have problems out there in which you're not getting anywhere with the problem, and then you look for some other choice that could solve that, that's my flight. Oversight is kind of like I have all these solutions out there desperately looking for a problem to fix. And I can definitely think of that in the cases of – and in a positive sense. I mean, I know that kind of sounded pejorative, but in a positive sense, when you go to, say, a convention where you have a lot of companies out there basically presenting their goods and services for the purposes of drumming up business, sometimes the solutions were created in anticipation of a problem that did not yet – actually exist or may have been in small scope. And it's like this solution worked. We think it can be applied much more broadly. So let's put it out there. So then in essence, by flight, you know, one is moving, you know, either the problem or the choice is moving. Flight is like one's moving and oversight is like the other one's moving. And perhaps if it was put in those terms, it might have been clearer.
Yes. So another implication I thought was interesting, although I think it goes to the heart of the darker mode or darker mood Miranda gets frustrated about. And I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's just they note that there's a tendency for decision makers and problems to track each other through the choices. And they go on to say that they'd expect decision makers might have a feeling that they're always working on the same problems in somewhat different contexts, mostly without results. So that is sort of a darker view of decision making. And then another one I thought was interesting, a summary theme, is that I wasn't quite sure what to make of this, but it is interesting. Important problems are more likely to be solved than unimportant ones. That seems kind of a trivial idea, but the idea is that organizations would put more energy and more resources and time into working on the important problems, and it would occupy the decision makers more deeply.
We can think about this as, you know, to make it less trivial, with the whole idea of neoclassic economics and this idea that, you know, if you think from a more neoclassical perspective, everyone is complete maximizing, resolving problems kind of machine, but actually – when you think at the organizational level, it makes sense to realize that problems have different weights and they have different implications and that require different kind of resources. So we enter the more organizational theory universe and leave more economics and think of, it requires specific effort because rationality is bounded. It's not, limited, has limits and blah, blah, blah. So we require different kind of, we can maybe treat unimportant problems in a routinized way, but important ones are hard because they involve some kind of uncertainty. So, it kind of, trickles down in all this kind of organizational dynamics that we know about.
I was going to throw in another idea related to this idea of important and unimportant problems that, yes, it seems quite obvious that the important ones are the ones that the organization is working on, but actually it may be the opposite, as in the really, really important ones are actually the most difficult to solve, as Piddle was saying. So maybe employees could be in a situation where it's easier to show that they're doing something, and to do something, it's better to follow routines and maybe problems that have been easily solved in the past. Yeah, so I think there's a bit of the thing that I find fascinating about this model is that you have a clear roots in economics and in rational thinking, but it's also trying to breach into the reality of everyday organizations, or organized anarchies to be more specific. But there's still a bit of contrast. So you have this very clear-cut and crystallized way of thinking. And yes, it would be nice if the world were like that, but actually it's like this. So it's as if there was one foot in both worlds. I'm not sure if you've got that feeling.
I was just going to say that what you're saying part links to the assumption number 8, in which they say that choice failures tend to be concentrated on the most important and least important choices. And and I think that's actually, again, it shows this deeper willingness to understand and look at organizations, how they really function, although we see we've anchored in this more economic-based kind of models. Because in a way, it's also, we can talk about this later, but I think it's opening the door to a number of things that we know today from psychology, from organizational culture, of what gets on the way of decision-making. How people have biases, how people have an escalation of commitment sometimes, how people actually will refrain from making choices because they want to think that, we can just ignore the problems. And how these things that we know that organizations, are unexpected but happen.
Right. And I think you can't go too deeply into the model to get that out. You've got to go look at behavioral kinds of research, or you have to include agency. But it is interesting that that feature of the model comes out. And then I think what you were talking about, Pedro, is a richer way to look at the problems when you use a different kind of research technique. And then the other one I thought was interesting, it was actually theme or implication 7, which was that important choices often appear to just happen because important choices are less likely to resolve problems than unimportant choices. Now, I thought several of the implications they go on to explore through a paragraph or so of more text. I wish they'd done that in the article on that one, because I thought that was very interesting, what that might really mean, in that, Miranda was talking earlier about, some of the important choices were related to important problems and they're difficult to resolve, and many of them, they can't be resolved in top-down fashion, and they have interactions amongst the participants and the problems. I get that. And I wish they talked just a little bit more about that in terms of what the model was telling them. But I do think that's an important theme they came up with.
I was kind of surprised that they arrived at that conclusion in a mathematical model where there really is no qualitative difference between the choices. Because, ordinarily, if you were to do this as a real simulation, perhaps you would have described some real qualitative differences between what constitutes an important and an unimportant. Because it makes sense that the unimportant would be handled rather blandly. You just, follow the process, off we go. Whereas the important ones are probably a bit more unique, probably a bit higher risk, probably puts the organization under pressure. None of that was even included in this model. I mean, it didn't go that far. And yet, that conclusion came about. So that was very striking to me.
Yeah. And as an organizational researcher, I would tell you, okay, a little unfulfilling in that it like Miranda's sort of depressing view of the way decisions are made. But also I think, well, there's a great area to go research further, right? To go see what's it really happened at universities, or what happens in various organizations that are anarchic or like this, and what are some of those interactions? And that's all for part one of episode 39. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you will also be able to subscribe to our newsletter.